Welcome to NGA Notable Lectures, a podcast offering a deeper understanding of all things artistic. Sculpture, especially figural sculpture, engages other bodies in multiple ways in film, heightening tensions between motion and stasis, the animate and inanimate, life and death, presence and absence, as well as embodying narrative themes. In this lecture, held on June 17, 2018, at the National Gallery of Art, Susan Fellman surveys some of the sculptural themes in her four books of scholarship on art and cinema, while also spotlighting a reciprocal aspect of this relationship, sculpture, particularly since the 1960s, that incorporates the medium of film.
My first book, which was actually a revision of my doctoral dissertation, and the book was published almost 21 years ago. I know that because, or about 21 years ago, because my daughter Hallie, who's about to turn 21, was a baby. It was called Botticelli in Hollywood, the films of Albert Lewin, and it's about the work of a Hollywood writer-producer of the classic era turned director of whom many of you have probably never heard. His best-known films are the 1945 MGM adaptation of The Picture of Dorian Gray, which you see a still from on the right, in which the titular portrait, its grotesque final incarnation painted by Ivan Albright, a fairly major American painter, appears in vivid Technicolor inserts. It was the second film in which Lewin created a black and white film that had color inserts. And there was one to come. His other perhaps well-known film is called Pandora and the Flying Dutchman, which is an original 1951 supernatural romance starring Ava Gardner and James Mason. And I will be returning to that film a couple times before my talk is over. You see a poster for it on the left. The poster's in color. The stills that are on the poster are in black and white. The still on the right is also in black and white, but it's a beautiful Technicolor film, which I highly recommend you check out if you have not seen it already. I picked this particular still on the right because it features in the foreground a little miniature portrait of Ava Gardner as a Renaissance bride, which is supposed to be like a little Holbein painting or something in the style of Renaissance painting, but is in fact a photograph by Man Ray, the modernist photographer and artist who Lewin was friendly with, became friendly with during Man Ray's American exile in the war years. One of his films, Lewin's films, most certainly deserves to be better known, the one illustrated on the cover of the book, The Private Affairs of Bel-Ami, which is an adaptation of Guy de Maupassant's novel, Bel-Ami. It also has a Technicolor insert of a painting, this time by Max Ernst. You see that, again, in black and white, still on the right-hand side, with George Saunders and Catherine Emery, actors in the film in front of it. That Ernst painting was actually the winner of a competition that Lewin mounted for a painting to appear in the film. And on the picture on the left shows Lewin with some of the submissions to the Bel-Ami competition that Ernst won. From left to right there, you see paintings by, again, Ivan Albright, Dorothea Tanning, Abraham Ratner, directly behind Lewin, Max Ernst's winning submission turned on its side. To the right of that, and somewhat obscured, Salvador Dali's submission, and at the very right, Horace Pippin's, and there were numerous other contributors to this, submitters to this competition, which was juried by Alfred Barr of the Museum of Modern Art, Marcel Duchamp, and Sidney Janis, who was a major gallerist of surrealism and other mid-century trends. So that was a really interesting sort of novelty and marketing aspect of the film, which is probably not well known enough. Another interesting aspect of the film is it has a beautiful score by Darius Milhaud, who was also in exile in the United States in the war years and got to know Lewin. all six of, oh, another interesting facet of the private affairs of Bellamy is that it was finally recently, very recently, within the past year or two, released on DVD for the first time. So you can find this film finally in a worthy format. All of Lewin's directorial films self-consciously incorporate fine art, music, dance, and literature, all of the arts. Very unusual in classic Hollywood movies, and it was what drew me to, as an art historian, to his work. This is my second book, the one I mentioned already. Art and the Cinematic Imagination was published in 2006 and involved years and years of research. It's a more theoretical investigation of what the fine arts have meant to the movies. The first two chapters deal with problems around the appearance of painted portraits in films. And paintings and sculptures work really differently in films. I'm not going to go into a long discourse on that, but because painting and film are both two-dimensional, paintings on a beam in depth in the scene often function in a very different way than sculpture, which has this material presence, this three-dimensional presence. Sculpture makes an appearance throughout the remainder of the studies in the book, but it's a focal theme of one chapter, chapter three, which considers the particular relationship between Ava Gardner's stardom and sculpture in three films. One of them is Pandora and the Flying Dutchman, which I already mentioned. The other two are both precede and follow it. One Touch of Venus, a comedy from the late 1940s, which you see, this is a production still, or not really even a production still, this is a photograph in color. Now we've got color representing black and white, because One Touch of Venus is a black and white film. This is Ava Gardner with the sculptor Joseph Nicolosi, who was a legitimate academic sculptor who created the not particularly wonderful statue of Ava Gardner as Venus for this comedy of the late 1940s. And the sort of bookend film in which Ava Gardner is seen in connection to art, especially in relationship to sculpture and statuary, is Joseph Mankiewicz's The Barefoot Contessa of 1954. You see a still of that, which is a Technicolor film on the right. And you see the character, Maria D'Amata, that Ava Gardner plays, posing for the sculpture of her that is made in the course of the narrative, but is also the first image that you see in the film. It's as her gravestone. It represents her dead at the very beginning of the film. That is also by fairly well-known of his period academic portraitist and sculptor, Asen Piakov, a Bulgarian artist who was active in Italy, where a lot of the film was shot. And there on the bottom, you see Ava Gardner, again, in relationship to statuary. That is probably a prop that was made for Pandora and the Flying Dutchman. It doesn't represent her, but you can see that it is made to sort of echo her, or that the mise-en-scene places her in relationship to sculpture, as well as to that photograph and to another painting. Lewin really poured it on, fine arts-wise. In this chapter, my argument has a lot to do with the way that statuary figures all kinds of different things, and in relationship to Ava Gardner, but in relationship to stardom, to movie goddesses, and so forth. In fact, the chapter in my book uses the word, it's called the birth and death of a Hollywood movie goddess, or something like that. Status. Stature, corporeality, fetishism of interest to film theorists, classicism, Hollywood classicism in relationship to sculptural classicism. There's all kinds of different discourses that end up getting sort of pulled into the fulcrum of Ava Gardner and statuary in these films and in my argument. Art is a narrative theme and visual presence in the films discussed in Art and the Cinematic Imagination, but it is often represented, art is often represented by reproductions, props, or in the case of those statues of Ava Gardner, objects fabricated to order, even though by artists, they're made, under such exigencies as are necessitated by production schedules, budgeting, and settings in the movies, and also how they're going to be used. So in my third and still rather recent book, which is one of the ones that you can see and have signed outside, afterwards. I turned my attention to the problem of what I, for lack of a better term, call real art. researching a series of case studies of the material significance of legitimate, real art objects, pre-existing or made under less movie-ish conditions in fiction films. In examining historical, political, personal realities that situate such works, I find that they operate in a way that kind of exceeds that of a prop or a reproduction or a pastiche, the more common appearances of art in films. This is a real theoretical problem, though, discerning a prop from a real thing. It's a problem that I pull apart in the book rather a lot, but can't go into any depth here. There's a way in which such real objects can actually become more like players in the narrative rather than just decor or objects. Several of the chapters in Real Art in Unreal Situations, Modern Art in Fiction Films consider films with artist characters and protagonists. At least three of these are sculptors. And here I'm going to turn my attention a little bit more to sculpture. Chapter one is about the 1933 Marlene Dietrich vehicle, The Song of Songs, for which an over life-size statue of Dietrich naked was made by sculptor Salvatore Carpiano Scarpita. And some of you may find the name Salvatore Scarpita familiar. His son was a very well-known contemporary sculptor of very different kinds of sculptors. But he was an Italian emigre that worked in Hollywood, in Los Angeles and Hollywood from the 1920s onward. This and a second, almost identical, because made from the same cast probably, plaster, which was needed because one of these, spoiler alert, one of these, this is smashed at the end of the film, are fine works, but they're still arguably props because they had to be made for these purposes under a tight budget schedule and budget and schedule by Scarpita. So they don't really fulfill the meaning of the book, but that doesn't matter because in order to sort of add to the verisimilitude of the scene, Ruben Mamoulian, the director of the film, actually arranged for other works by Scarpita himself, or at least one major work by Scarpita himself. It's actually the one that you see in the background behind Marlene Dietrich on the book cover, and the head of it above, and works by quite a few other Los Angeles area figurative sculptors to appear in the setting, which is the sculptor's atelier in the film. So there's some really interesting scenes in the film in which the artist and model, Marlene Dietrich, the young peasant girl who comes to Berlin and becomes the model for this, interact with the settings and these real sculptures in really interesting ways. One of the subjects of chapter two of this book is a film called Venus vor Gericht, Venus in the Dock, a 1941 Nazi period German film set about a decade earlier in the Weimar era art world. The protagonist is a neoclassical sculptor. A female nude sculpture he had made and buried is unearthed and taken to be a veritable antiquity in the plot of this film. You see that Venus, thought to be a veritable antiquity on the right, in between the sculptor protagonist on the right and its model on the left. So it has certain echoes of the Song of Songs. The antagonist in this Nazi film is a Jewish gallerist who deals in modern art. And the production furnished his gallery with works of actual entartete Kunst, so-called degenerate art, that was purged from German museums and private collections, reviled by the Nazis in a series of infamous exhibitions. And most of the works seen in the film disappeared during the war. So this is their last appearance in this film. However, two of them were among the cache of damaged works excavated in Berlin a few years ago on the site of a war period bombing that you may remember was much in the news. So that film is really interesting for the way that it is actually a documentation of, and it was not well known at all that the settings of these films included actual stolen Antarktische Kunst. Chapter three in this penultimate book is about abstract paintings by John Ferran, a fairly major modern painter associated with the abstract expressionists in New York. He was active in Europe in the interwar period, and then very active in New York in the post-World War II period. His paintings function as those of the painter Sam Marlowe's in Alfred Hitchcock's film The Trouble with Harry, which came out in 1955. And you can see us still there of John Forsythe as the painter and a whole bunch of his paintings, which are for sale at a sort of farm stand in the small New Hampshire town where he lives and works. This was Hitchcock's favorite among his films, so if you haven't seen it, there is any number of reasons to check it out. A few years after The Trouble with Harry, Ferran also worked with Hitchcock on Vertigo. He painted the not particularly distinguished portrait of Carlotta, which is very important in the film, and he also designed one of the crazier dream sequences in film history for Vertigo. Returning to sculpture, chapter four of that book concerns Joseph Losey's 1961 film, The Damned. If you know it, you might have seen it as re-edited for the US audience. It was made in the UK as These Are the Damned, a dystopian science fiction film and social critique in which Vivica Lindfors plays Freya, a principal character of the film who is a sculptor, and her work is played by the sculpture of Elizabeth Frink. Frink was loosely connected to a group of British sculptors whose work, with which Franks has distinct affinities, as Herbert Reed characterized it, embodied a geometry of fear. So she wasn't in the Venice Biennale exhibition Herbert Reed organized that was called The Geometry of Fear, but her style, a little more figurative than some of those, really connects to this sort of ambiance of sort of existential dread and angst that was prevalent among certain circles, certainly in Europe generally, in the post-war period, the geometry of fear. Frink's scarred, distressed human and animal works embody dread and the threat of annihilation. The plot of this film involves radioactive children bred to survive a nuclear Armageddon. At the same time as the artworks and the artist character also serve to represent a kind of redemptive aspect of art. There's a kind of virtue associated with art in connection to the sort of cold-blooded technocrats and damaged youth who are the other kinds of protagonists in the film. There's these radioactive children, there's teddy boys, there's technocrats, and there's the artist who is the most sort of, she has the sort of virtuous last word in a sense in the film. And again, The sculptures are not just decor, they're very, very actively engaged by the narrative, especially at key points. A primary focus of chapter five is the use of Paul Jenkins's large, luminous canvases as those of the character Sauls, a painter, in Paul Mazursky's 1978 film, An Unmarried Woman, and the way that their use of color, light, and liquidity might be understood to give form to themes of female sexual liberation and pleasure. This is contrasted to the woman artist herself as an object of male fantasy in Robert Altman's The Player, in which Greta Scacchi plays an artist who is as elusive and insubstantial as her art. The last chapter of Real Objects in Unreal Situations deals with the most recent of the films discussed, the 2005 adaptation of Jane Austen's Pride and Prejudice, but the least recent modern art. It focuses on the scene of Elizabeth's visit to Pemberley In the film played by Chatsworth House, the home of the Dukes of Devonshire, a key scene in the film is set in Chatsworth's famous Hall of Marbles, which were sculptures collected by the sixth Duke in the first half of the 19th century. My very close reading of the scene posits that Austen's narrative is changed or amended for the 21st century by the eloquent scene of embodied female looking and desire, which I think you can sort of see in this still. My most recent book is a co-authored one, and it's also available here today. It is not a comprehensive, but a very wide-ranging survey of the relationship between sculpture and film from the beginning of cinema to the present. It consists of an introduction by Stephen Jacobs, one of my co-authors, setting the stage for some of the significant themes and motifs in the book. 8 chapters and a sculpture gallery. There's the cover of it. I forgot. And here's the table of contents. You can see the 8 chapters there. I am the author of 3 of them. And then there's a sculpture gallery at the end, which is short capsule entries on 150 statues from American and European and American cinema by the junior co-authors of the book who were graduate students who worked on the research project that Stephen and I were the co-principals of. I was going to sort of walk you through the book, but I'm looking at the time, and I don't think I really have time to, other than to just sort of give you a slide for each chapter. I'm not going to stop to say much, except for maybe about my chapters. These are sort of loosely, chronologically organized around different themes that we have noticed are significant in the historical relationship of sculpture to moving pictures. One of those themes is walking statues and statues coming alive. That happens in many ways in the history of cinema, including in the surrealist orbit, famously in Blood of a Poet. You see a still from that there. My chapter on surreal and surrealist cinema concentrates on the 3 films that were made at the behest of, or I should say financed by, the Vicomte de Noailles, who was a major patron of the arts, and he commissioned from Jean Cocteau, Louis Buñuel, and Man Ray in 1929 and 1930, these films, all of which feature sculpture in really interesting ways. So that's what this chapter is about. Here's 2 of those films. Documentaries, mid-century documentaries on sculpture. Wax museum films, clearly sculptural themes. Here's my second chapter, which is probably innovative in bringing together avant-garde films and commercial films from the post-war period in terms of certain kinds of propensities and themes. You can see an avant-garde film, James Broughton's Mother's Day, on the left, and another clip from Pandora and the Flying Dutchman by Lewin on the right, to demonstrate the kind of erotic and fantastic coming together of sculpture and motion pictures, which is the theme of this chapter. Major representations of sculpture in modernist films of the post-war period is the subject of the next chapter. The second to last chapter is another of the chapters that deals with this motion picture's love of the idea of statues coming to life, in this case in Swords and Sandals types of epics. And then the last chapter of the book is one that I insisted upon because it's a theme that's long interested me and is really been rather neglected, and it's the one that's the subject of the remainder of my talk today. I called it a coda because it's rather short, but it also turns the tables and allows us to look at the problem of the relationship between sculpture and film in another way. As opposed to the incorporation of sculpture in movies, it deals with the problem of sculpture that incorporates film. And the remainder of this talk is adapted from that coda. The first 7 chapters had together demonstrated that sculpture, especially figural sculpture, engages the living figure in a range of intermedial ways in film. intermedial is a kind of fashionable word now, but I'll stop to just point out that it refers to media coming together. So we're regarding sculpture and film as different media in this terminology. It heightens the tensions around motion and stasis, the animate and the inanimate, life and death, presence and absence, as well as often embodying particular narrative themes. And this is, in theory, as true for sculptures that play a small role as props or minor plot devices as for those that are central actors. So I've mainly focused on, in this talk, movies that include sculptors and sculpture artists as major themes. But it isn't always necessarily the case. In Rear Window, for instance, a Hitchcock film that is not, it's about a photographer, actually, but he's a journalist, not an artist. It's not about artists per se. There is still art that behaves interestingly. That abstract sculpture on which a neighbor of Jeff's is shown working is seen briefly and intermittently in the film, but it's really overdetermined. The lady artist is a Greenwich Village cliche, and she is ridiculed along predictably sexist lines. Along with the dancer and the composer, who are among Jeff's other neighbors, she exemplifies the bohemian milieu in which Jeff lives in ways that are both realistic and comical. The sculpture itself, as with the ballerina referred to as Miss Torso, that's who you're seeing here from across the courtyard in Rear Window, is suggestive of almost a substitute for the dismembered body of Mrs. Thorwald that cannot be shown, only imagined. Although it suggests an abstracted partial figure or bust, it consists primarily of a phallic form and a yonic one, a protuberance and a void, inserting into the scene psychosexual symbolism that underscores Hitchcock's voyeuristic and perverse themes. If sculpture can contribute intermedial meaning and complexity to a film, is not the opposite equally true? While cinema often incorporated sculpture from very early on in film history, as is evident from that survey of the chapters of the book, sculpture was very slow to return that favor. In the 1920s and 30s, sculpture began to move with mobile and kinetic innovations such as Joie de Vivre, a sculpture on a rotating base by Jacques Lipschitz. That sculpture was owned by the Noailles, and it was seen in the film, the third film that was discussed in my Surrealism chapter, Les Mystères du Château de Day, which was a film that Man Ray shot at the Noailles Villa in the south of France. So you see it on the left in the film, you actually see it in motion more than once. So other moving sculptures of the 1920s and 30s include Alexander Calder's Mobiles, you just walked under one, and Moholy Nagy's Light Space Modulator, which is discussed in Stephen Jacobs' introduction to the book very extensively, as well as some constructivist works that incorporate movement and therefore change in time, dynamizing a previously static practice. Numerous artists, among them George Rickey, Jean Tanguy, Harry Bertoia, and artist filmmakers like Robert Breer and Len Lai, enlarged and energized the field of kinetic sculpture beginning in the 1950s. It was not until the period of the 1960s and 70s, in the context of expanded cinema and structural materialist film, that sustained, varied, and truly intermedial experimentation began to produce a critical mass of work incorporating the materials and methods of film itself within sculpture. In one of the earliest such instances, Robert Whitman combined sculpture and the cinematic image in a voyeuristic tableau as reminiscent of Alfred Hitchcock's Rear Window as it is of Duchamp's Étant Donné. The architectonic material setting of window expands the pictorial frame into sculpture at the same time that it deconstructs by reifying the illusion of the cinematic image as a window. It's one of the real conventions of cinema, is that you're sort of looking through something into a world that unfolds beyond. Built into a gallery wall, the sculptural elements comprise a real ordinary window frame and glass, beyond which are actual tree branches. Beyond the Branches is an illusory moving image, a rear screen film projection of a forest glen where branches shift faintly in a gentle breeze and a woman suddenly appears, remains for a moment, and then quickly vanishes. Just occurred to me that in addition to sort of being a reference to Rear Window, it could be a reference to another Hitchcock film, The Lady Vanishes. Intermedially, merging architectonic space and cinematic projection, literally trespassing on the architectural boundary, it opens up a space beyond that is both physical and metaphorical, as Andrew Urofsky writes. Window is not merely a hole, but an aperture. The next year, in another evident nod to Hitchcock, this time to Psycho, Whitman created Shower and deepened the sculptural and ontological space upon which the cinematic image was projected. At the first New York Theater Rally in 1965, then during Billy Cluver and Robert Rauschenberg's Nine Evenings, Theater and Engineering in 1966, Whitman exhibited Shower, a real working shower stall, with a film of a woman rear projected on the frosted glass of the working of the rear wall, with a translucent shower curtain in front. Accounts often erroneously claim that the film is projected on the shower curtain. Michael Kirby recalls that viewers sometimes felt some uncertainty as to whether the woman seen through the screen of steam and vinyl was real or not. Although, as Andrew Urofsky notes, an active suspension of disbelief is manifested not only in historical descriptions, but in the photographic documentation that has accompanied the work's exhibition, since the film image not only included illusionistic long shots of the life-size showering nude woman, but also discontinuous cuts to close-up views, including of the shower head spraying variously colored water. So you'd have to, if you actually had a sustained viewing of the thing, you couldn't possibly imagine that you were seeing a woman showering. Whitman's expanded field of sculptural practice includes not only the material technology of cinema, Urofsky notes, but also the identificatory relations that have dominated the cultural history of that technology. Whitman's cinema pieces implicitly interrogate voyeuristic properties of moviegoing, creating unease by making present that which the viewer depends on to be absent, bringing the film object and the viewing subject into physical co-presence. We enjoy watching nude women in movies because they don't see us watching them. And that this work defies that convention of cinematic illusion. With structural and materialist film in the later 1960s and 1970s, it was the device itself that was bared, rather than the illusoriness of the cinematic object and the unconscious of the viewing subject. Insisting upon the materiality of the film, the camera, the projector, and the screen, interrogating and exposing mechanisms and process, deconstructing the apparatus, structural and materialist film sometimes converged with sculpture, architecture, and performance. The 1971 Cone Screen by Arthur and Corinne Cantrell, for instance, turned the familiar yet normally immaterial volume of the projected film's cone of light into geometric solid and surface. The anamorphic attenuation of the film image upon this sculptural structure. What you're seeing here is actually, you know, film, sort of normal photographic film imagery distorted by being projected onto this cone-shaped screen. This was one of several sculptural screens created by the Cantrells for their expanded cinema events. As we viewers have known from the beginning of cinema, occasionally experienced ourselves when a body interposes itself between the projector and the screen, this in a sense reifies what Walter Benjamin referred to as the optical unconscious, that capacity of the photographic to reveal properties of matter, movement, space, and time that are not visible to the naked eye. 2 years after the Cantrells, Anthony McCall, whose own exploration of the sculptural aspects of the luminous cone is much more famous, created the first in a series of experiments in solid light projection. Line describing a cone, 1973, creates a virtual sculpture in time and space using the volume of the beam of light articulated in darkness by the simple animated film drawing of a white circle on a black background. So what you're seeing in the screen is a half to two-thirds of a film of a line, a circular line being drawn on a black ground. And when it's projected, it, it creates this cone, this virtual solid light projection, as he calls it. The beam from the projector gradually develops from a line into a cone, and the effect in space and time is really ineffably magical, almost mystical, and impossible to capture photographically. I can't see your hands, but has anybody ever experienced the Anthony McCall projection? One, two. If you ever have an opportunity, they happen now and then. You can actually rent this film from Filmmakers Cooperative and stage your own sculptural happening with it. It is not, it is really impossible to capture either photographically or cinematically, although you'll see a little bit of his work coming up. First realized as a sort of theatrical screening experience, line describing a cone was followed by other solid light projections in the 70s. These pieces are visible in three-dimensional space, McCall notes. Quote, because the projected light is reflected off tiny particles in the air. Recalling that lofts were early venues, McCall continues, when I projected film then, I could rely on the dust particles in the air, which would often be augmented by a couple of smokers. Now, in cleaner venues where smoking is prohibited, his sculptural medium includes, instead of dust motes and smoke, a fog machine, which does a far more effective job of making visible the planes of light. And I have to admit that the only circumstances in which I've seen it projected were with a fog machine, not in the authentic atmosphere of smoky, dirty downtown lofts. And here's Anthony McCall.
These solid light projections do have these two faces. They exist as a sculptural form, a three-dimensional volumetric object, which you can walk around, go into, and explore. But when you turn around, you also see that that volumetric form derives from a two-dimensional drawing. In the 70s, all my solid light works were horizontal. This was, of course, normal because they were working, it came out of cinema. Film projectors were designed to sit flat on tables and produce horizontal images on the wall. But when I began working again in the beginning of 2001 or 2 or something like that, of course I was working with a new kinds of projectors, digital projectors. And I quickly realized that they were not gravity bound like a film projector. And I began to explore vertical projections and became increasingly interested by the way in which they aligned themselves much more with a sculptural tradition than with a cinematic tradition. Because they, you know, one began to think of them as vertical figures, standing figures.
Anthony McCall's digital turn, his 21st century work, Monumental Immaterial Figures of Paradoxically Solid Light, uses 21st century tools, that is, QuickTime movies and digital projection, and it raises the question of medium specificity, as did, of course, 30 years early, another medium that arose in the era of expanded cinema and that also lent itself to becoming sculpture, and that is video. Also time-based, and like film, vehicles for moving pictures and sound, television and video have or had medium-specific attributes that lend themselves to a somewhat different sort of intermedial practice, other ways of becoming sculpture. The relationship of video to television, its traditional common form, a domestic furnishing, gave it, in the period before flat screen television, an always already sculptural form. You'll recall, those of you above a certain age, that the TV was a thing in space, not a screen. Television sets, unlike movie screens, were not only three-dimensional objects on a human scale. Screen, the ideal movie screen is like this, really big, and television was always something that fit into the home. They were also viewable in gallery spaces regardless of lighting conditions. If you've seen video installed in galleries, you've usually seen it in fully lit or almost fully lit galleries. until later. Moreover, a common attribute of some TV and much video art was one that film always lacked: liveness. Nam June Paik and others explored this liveness by incorporating the live feed into sculptural tableau. For instance, TV Buddha, in which a Buddha figurine sits contemplating his live video image on a television set. And by playing with live signals and with the receiving and displaying mechanisms of the apparatus, as in these two works, and for TV and magnet TV. Unlike the film image, which was fixed, although it could be performed and screened at different speeds, in different directions, on different surfaces, and on space itself, as the Cantrells and McCall and others demonstrated, the live video image was essentially plastic in the moment of its reception. Even in its recorded form, videotape, which is analog but not truly indexical, not a physical imprint of the image, was usually employed differently, clearly making video art related to, but something else other than cinema. If the video display could be built into a cabinet or a console for the home, it could also be built into other three-dimensional structures and incorporated into sculpture and installations. In my first museum job, I worked on an installation in which video monitors were in the wheel holes of an army jeep, for instance. That was a piece by Frances Torres. Shigeko Kubota was one of many artists who created video sculptures, works in which the fluid moving image, often looped, was encased dialectically in sculptural stasis. For instance, Duchampiana, nude descending a staircase, another Duchamp illusion seen here on the right. Video installation would become a new expanded media practice of its own, or it might be more accurate to say was one of a number of practices that defied or rejected the concept of medium itself. There is a distinction to be made between works that juxtapose elements of different disciplines in surprising ways that nonetheless maintain, if not reinforce, the distinctions between them, as Catherine Elwes observes, and those which, as filmmaker Michael Snow commented, we witness one medium eating another medium. So there are these different forms of intermediality, some attending to the nature of the medium, some not really. The development of video projection further expanded the possibilities of sculpting and performing in video, and perhaps ironically, or perhaps not, since what goes around comes around, due to the now again disembodied moving image in projected video, brought these around to experiences closely linked to the cinematic. From the early 1990s, Tony Orsler, for instance, has used video loops and LCD projection onto soft sculpted forms to re-embody the ray of light, creating these uncanny video dolls or dummies. In a further turn enabled by video projection and away from real-time bodily experiences and towards the cinematic, many recent moving image installations are characterized by high production values, the use of narratives, character, viewer identification, and other hallmarks of the movies. And you've experienced these in black boxes at museums here and elsewhere, no doubt. Nonetheless, film installations by artists such as Ayelisa Attila, Bill Viola, Matthew Barney, Douglas Aitken, Douglas Gordon, and among others, although they clearly differ from the phenomenological preoccupations of the 1970s expanded cinema and video art, yet retain certain sculptural aspects of installation in which a spatial layout, the presence of the projector and the beam of light it produces, the form and size of the screens, and the spectator's viewing position are consciously taken into account. To give just one example, when I used the ladies' room at the MMK, Frankfurt's Museum for Modern Art, last summer, I heard a faint, echoey woman's voice and encountered in the toilet stall a video piece by Pippolotti Rist projected on the floor. The explosion of new digital technologies and possibilities in the 1990s that enabled these new uses of projection coincided, as it happened, with the centenary of cinema, contributing to a surge of nostalgia, rediscovery, and anxiety around the already seemingly obsolescent media of traditional film and photography. A renewal of scholarly and artistic interest in the prehistory of cinema and early cinema led to new intermedial objects inspired by old practices. Experimental filmmaker Carrie Laidlaw refers to her retrospectoscope as a kinetic sculptor gigantorous philosophical toy. Made of a sheet of plexiglass 5 feet in diameter and mounted on a motorized stand and illuminated from behind, the paracinematic object creates the illusion of movement utilizing large format still images accompanied by strobes and sound. You hear the sound. Gregory Barsamian began making stroboscopic sculptures in the early 1990s. His pieces dispense entirely with photographic imagery, yet also return to the origins of cinema while expanding the zoetropic image into a third dimension. The same principles that animate motion pictures, the series, the interval, and your human perception, animate Barsamian's work, including feral font, which you're seeing here, a stroboscopic zoetrope using 97 sculptures on a rotating armature. The American Museum of the Moving Image, as you can see in this video, displays the spinning work by alternating normal gallery lighting conditions with a strobe so that viewers can partake of the illusion and its mechanisms. Takeshi Murata's more recent stroboscopic sculpture, Melter 3D, substitutes slick, high-tech 21st century facture and documentation for the structure of feeling associated with Laidlaw's and Barsamian's more handcrafted 19th century style proto-cinematic magic. But like theirs, Murata's kinetic sculpture also depends upon strobe lights for for its wondrous liquidity. So this was photographed using a strobe, and if you actually saw the piece, it would not have this magical quality. Murata spent months configuring the object on a computer before making a physical incarnation with a master fabricator and mechanical engineers who typically work on high-profile Hollywood CGI projects. While Murata's dazzling liquid sculpture is consistent with the technological wizardry characteristic of much mainstream cinema of the moment, there remains an obdurate commitment to the stuff of film among many artists and filmmakers, including among some who work intermedially. Elizabeth McAlpine's Square Describing a Circle, whose title is an implicit homage to Anthony McCall's line describing a cone of nearly 40 years earlier, is a sort of neo-structural or materialist film sculpture displayed in two forms. It began with the notion of a shadow of a perfect square, McAlpine says. She filmed the sunlight on a spot of gravel path in Hyde Park, London, moving the stencil a degree at a time during the course of a 12-hour day. In the installation, a film loop runs through two Super 8 projectors and two projected squares upon a shared glass screen, merging into a sort of flickering square beam of light that seems to turn in a circle. And in a second material iteration of the same project, which you see on the right, Square Describing a Circle, Film Stack, 10th of May, McAlpine seeks to statically embody and represent the passage of that same 12-hour time period. Each of the 181 cards that she made 1 degree at a time, held in place by a steel spine, represents 1 degree and 4 minutes of the Earth's rotation around the sun. On each, the shape of a cast shadow has been cut away. So this is two different iterations of the same very time-space structured concept. Time-based materiality takes another form in 98 meters, the height of the Campanile San Marco Venice in Super 8 millimeter film, 2005, for which McAlpine calculated the height of the tower and timed her photography of it so that the length of the film in meters is exactly the height of the tower. So if this spool of film were hung from the tower, it would go from top to bottom. The 98 meters of film represent a space-time equivalent, shown in time, the projection of the film, and space, the recursive loop of film that is displayed in a plexiglass container beneath the projector. So instead of having a take-up reel, the 98 meters of film create this lovely recursive loop at the bottom in the plexi. The investment in the material and materiality of film evident in the work of McAlpine and others working in the growing shadow of digital dominance has since the turn of the 21st century taken an elegiac turn. The possible or likely obsolescence of the medium of film has given rise to a range of practices that employ the material detritus and surplus of the age of film. In Sandra Gibson and Luis Recoder's Light Spill, a 16-millimeter projector with no take-up reel on it projects and unspools discarded films into a sculptural heap that grows daily during the course of the installation. Here, the controlled recursion of McAlpine's 98 meters of film swells into a mass of obsolescence and waste. These artists can, because film really is so obsolescent, can acquire enough discarded film to mount this installation over many days in many different locations. Wherever they go, they can collect thrown away film. Other artists employ discarded film as a mortal medium, recycling and repurposing it as they mourn. Zabrina Geschwantner's film quilts, a series she began in 2009, hover between two and three dimensionality. The artist acquired 16 millimeter textile documentaries discarded by the Fashion Institute of Technology. After watching the movies, I cut them up and sew them together with my own personal film footage, Geschwantner relates. I bleach, dye, scratch, draw, and paint onto some of the film. These quilted films may be more flat than volumetric. It's a little bit of a stretch to put them in a sculpture talk, but their insistently crafted surfaces have nothing of the insubstantiality of the images these bits of film would have once had on the screen. A film that is projected has no tactile presence whatsoever. Film is also among the manifold materials that Arturo Alonso Sandoval has incorporated into his multimedia quilts. For instance, this one. Lynn Casaubon's Discard series, 2001 to 2009, is perhaps arguably 2D, as it consists of photographs. But the photographs are of discarded films arranged into sculptural compositions featuring spills and swirls and ribbons of film plasticity as imagery, or instead of imagery. Casaubon's are recursive intermedial images as well because they're photographs of sculptures of films. Alexandra Zeylon, too, recycles discarded film. Like Casaubon, McAlpine, and Geschwantner, Zeylon in what was and is a 2010 installation of sculpted 16 millimeter film was drawn to the ribbon-like nature of the material as well as its translucency. Her film objects not only salvage and transform the film strip into sculptural arabesque, they are also often installed as mobiles, suspended moving images in space with a sensitivity to the medium's history and purpose as a material in motion and through which light and shadow dance. In order to experience a film, you're experiencing something that has to be in motion. For all these artists, the increasing and widespread perception of film's uselessness and the resultant availability of reel upon discarded reel of it and a sensitivity to the particular plasticity of the medium results in a paradoxical sort of reincarnation. We're getting close to the end. On occasion, this plastic engagement with the film strip extends into space almost architecturally. In Film as Sculpture, a 2013 exhibition in Brussels, among other contemporary artists working intermedially, Zbigniew Baladron and Yuri Kavanda installed the nervous system in which film traverses space as nerves do the body, drawing upon both film's status as communication medium and a plastic one. Visitors to the exhibition seem to have found themselves caught in the installation as if in a web, instantiating the tension between medium and metaphor. Even more architectural than the nervous system is Agnès Varda's La Cabane de Cinéma, Cinema's Shack, made originally as Ma Cabane de l'Échec for her 2006 exhibition at the Cartier Foundation. Based on one of the beach huts at Noirmoutier, the island where she vacationed for many years with her late husband Jacques Demy and her family, the house is made from salvaged prints of her 1966 film Les Créatures, The Creatures. The film, unsuccessful in its day, as she put it, now became the walls and surface bathed in light. What is cinema, she asked, rhetorically in her film The Beaches of Agnes. Light coming from somewhere, captured by images, more or less dark or colorful. And here, it feels like I live in cinema. Cinema is my home. Varda's housemaid of film is a domestic act, an act of salvage, recycling, like Geschwantner's or Zeilan's, also an act of imagination, resourcefulness, and especially of mourning, a memorial. In Varda's case, the cinema that is mourned is not just random, anonymous cinematic detritus, it is personal. Varda mourns her own failed film, but also builds a house of retrospection, a tomb of light and beauty for herself, her no longer youthful stars, Deneuve and Piccoli, her late husband, Jacques Demy, and for bygone days. For Tacita Dean, it is the medium itself at stake. In the catalog that accompanied Film, her 2011 piece for the enormous Turbine Hall at the Tate Modern in London, she wrote that it was inspired by grieving the potential loss of medium, her medium. The screen onto which her film, a title that expresses Dean's commitment to the medium writ large, was projected was no mere surface, but a colossal part of the work itself, a monumental object 13 meters high and 1 meter deep, in fact referred to as the monolith, a term and an image that conjures Stanley Kubrick's 2001, of course. Turned from the horizontal axis of the usual film, this vertical monolith attests to the monumentality of the medium for Dean, but also recalls the format of a gravestone. Of course, as Anthony McCall pointed out, the vertical is a more sculptural or figural orientation than the horizontal. Is Tacita Dean turning medium specificity on its side? In an essay on the piece, Rosalind Krauss suggests otherwise, noting that structural filmmakers had already endeavored to uncover among the heterogeneous apparatus of film the nature of it as a medium by taking it apart and experimenting with its parts, the screen, beam of light, camera, projector, the film strip itself, she observes that the sprocket holes prominent in Dean's film, created using a custom-built aperture gate that functioned also as a mask, figure forth the film strip itself, not only as the material support for the image, but as the apparatus for its projection. The sprocket holes are the way that the film advances. In this figuring forth, Krauss continues, Dean asserts the specificity of her medium. Film thus runs headlong against the contemporary conviction that there is no itself to which a medium of any kind can be specific. Krauss concludes that Dean's piece is a heroic bulwark against what she, Krauss, regards as the meretricious and vulgar notion of the post-medium condition. This monument to the materiality of film is, ironically perhaps, profoundly medium-specific and intermedial at the same time. In a sense, it illuminates the fact that there can be no intermediality without medium. By becoming sculpture, film has given form to itself. I'm done.
This has been a National Gallery of Art podcast.